Ole! Ole! It's showtime!
You are listening to The Mini Minxes, the UK's newest Disney podcast. It's a mischievous way to start your week. Disney Girl Power!
Well, it's that time again. It's time for The Mini Minxes.
Good evening, Mini Minx fans, or good morning, dependent on when you are listening. How is everyone?
Aye, bit of a snazzy entrance this week. I was bored of saying same old thing, so I thought I'd jazz it up a bit.
Keeping things fresh, Kimster, I like your thinking.
I threw you off though, didn't I?
Yeah. Oh, well, you see, I've just been obviously busy today, you know, getting the old Lilo out of the garage, blowing it up, and going for a nice little float along the roads, because all the roads over by us in Yorkshire are flooded. Woohoo!
Who's left the tap on again?
Oh, it wasn't me, Mum, promise.
It's horrible over here in this part of England at the moment.
I'm getting back to the point where I might be building that ark again.
Oh, well, don't forget, I've already booked my Fastpass VIP space for me and dog.
What about Aaron?
Oh, well, he'll have to go in standby line.
He can sort of power it by running and dragging the arc behind him.
Well, you see, he thinks he's almighty marathon man. That's what he can do.
Yeah, we've got to have a creative use of our lovely menfolk. So, over the last fortnight since we were last together, Kimster, what have you been up to?
Oh, well, getting presents from you.
Yay!
Michelle was so kind to bring me back a few bits and bobbins from her latest trip to Florida, one of them being an absolute amazing personalised drawing of one said Stitch, which obviously is my favourite character, and I can't believe she had it done. It was fantastic. Yay. Really nice, really love it.
I know. The lovely artist, Kerry, who was over at Hollywood Studios, ended up with getting 6 commissions from me to do all these personalised bits of art. Very impressed with her, and we will be talking about Disney and art in a future episode, so...
Stay tuned for that one.
Indeed, indeed. I gather you've been over to visit my favourite American-style diner, though, Miss Kim.
I have, and I don't know whether to actually mention this or not, because I quite like the idea of it being a hidden gem. I really do, but if you are, shall I share it or shan't we share it?
Well, let's not name names and say that if anyone wants to know where our secret hidden gem of an American diner with what Kim described to me as the best chocolate milkshake she's ever had.
Best milkshake ever.
Drop us a little bit of a tweet, and we might give you one or two clues.
Yeah.
And what else have I been up to? Well, I've had a busy, busy old time of things, but I can't literally remember what I've actually done.
Well, you had a very important person around your house on Monday.
You?
Yeah.
Drunk all my coffee.
Drunk all the coffee, and she did check my bags before I left. I aren't kidding. She did a Vinyl Nation count. She did a Dooney and Burke bag count before I was even allowed to leave.
Is that right?
Oh, I don't know what you think I am.
Oh. Tell you what I did do. I've forgotten something really important. I've been able to procure a copy of Cinderella on Blu-ray, Diamond Edition, so I can't wait to watch that because it's got the little Tangled Happily Ever After type shot at the end. Mm-hmm. Very excited about that. I have been tweeting some lovely listeners and friends on Twitter, and I think I'll mention more about that towards the end of the show because there's a few people I'd like to give a bit of a shout out to. But other things, Kim, I've just been trying to console myself with the Disney blues and just trying to speak to the lovely people who are going on their jollies shortly and sort of doing my sad face and asking them to please... Can we do some sort of deal and bring me some Disney magic back?
I might do if you're nice to me.
Aw, thank you, Kimster.
Also, Michelle's just told me we've happened to appear in the What's Hot or Not in Travel or Summer on iTunes, you think?
It is indeed. We have appeared in this week's What's Hot section on the Travel, Places and Culture, I think, category on the iTunes list. So that's obviously meaning our listening figures are going up. Thank you very much. It's amazing to be included in this. One thing you might have noticed is we've had a little tweak with our name, haven't we, Kim?
Yes, after a much heated debate on Monday afternoon, basically Michelle has got her own way.
Woohoo!
But only because she bought me an amazing gift bag and plied me with coffee, which I'm sure she drugged.
Yeah. It had special... Kim will do everything that Michelle asks of her magic in it. So you will now find us as the Mini Minxes Disney podcast. And this hopefully will enable people who are searching on iTunes that want to find some Disney magic. They might come across our podcast. But if we could ask all our lovely listeners to please tweet out when you're listening, share us on Facebook, recommend us to friends, we would be so grateful, wouldn't we, Kim?
Yes, we would. We'd be extremely grateful. And please send your emails and stuff in, because we obviously liked hearing from you. Michelle's going to touch on that a bit later on in the show.
I am indeed.
But I suppose after much whining and wittering and explaining what we've been doing, we best tell everybody what's on the show.
Shall indeed. Well, we have two amazing things that are going to be happening on today's show. First one, I managed to get hold of a Disney author to come on the show and tell us about his current book that he has written and his next book, which is about to hit the shops very, very soon. And that is the lovely Jeff Dixon, who you can find on Twitter as Dixon on Disney. His book, oh my heavens, if you haven't yet got it, bye. Wow, it is a fabulous read, and he's going to tell you all about it. So hopefully you might go ahead and buy it. You might not. It might not be your cup of tea. But even so, this guy actually grew up in Orlando while the parks were being built. So he's got one or two little stories he wants to share, hasn't he, Kim?
It was extremely fascinating, and I kept saying to him at the time, I just couldn't get my head around the fact I was actually speaking to somebody who was in Orlando before Disney was even built.
We'll play that a bit later on, but I think we're going to be joined by someone shortly.
Oh, we are, yes. A friend of the show, a very good friend of the show, co-host of another Disney podcast. A bit boy-y for my tastes, but I still listen on the sly.
Our guest that is joining us this evening is Nick Branch from the Diz After Dark podcast. And by the powers of teleportation or
Skype,
we are going to contact him now.
Hi, girls. How are you doing?
Not so bad. And yourself?
Yeah, not too bad, thank you. Not too bad at all.
Hello, Mr. Branch.
Miss Goodwin, how are we?
I'm not too bad, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad at all.
Very good.
Well, seems we have our honorary minx for the next sort of few moments or so. We can take a little bit from your podcast and to make you feel nice at home and feeling comfortable. Have you got a drink in front of you?
You know what? Like, ruining tradition, no. Very, very lame. I mean, I can imagine one. It's a school night, so we'll have a mojito.
So you hit hard liquor on a school night, do you?
Well, you know, when in Rome.
That's your imaginary drink. Go on, Kim, what's your imaginary drink?
Oh, I'm having the best chocolate milkshake ever.
That's quite a statement there.
It is. I have found the best chocolate milkshake ever, but I'm not allowed to tell anybody where it is. Sorry, Michelle found it.
Oh, okay. So both of you don't know then. So it's like a kind of mini mink secret then.
Oh yeah.
Oh, I see. Right, okay. All right, Disney podcast community. Right, now I know what the rules are about. Right,
well, actually, actually, Kim, there are a couple of listeners that know where it is because the wonderful, the amazing Tim and Kerry Craggs came out with me and my husband Tom to have the best chocolate secret milkshake in the world. So the secret's seeping away.
Oh, dear.
Mm.
It's
Can I go with a Dole Whip, please? Pineapple float.
I've never had a Dole Whip. It's embarrassing, isn't it?
It's all right, Nick. I am either.
You both call yourself Disney podcasters.
Well, so your secret's revealed. The thing is, like my trips to Disney World, I'd never heard of a Dole Whip. So it's only since really kind of getting more involved in the community and everyone going mad about them, the fact that I've not been able to make myself go out there yet. But, I mean, it's obviously the first thing I'll do when I touch down in Orlando when I next go in about 5 years' time.
Well,
of course, anyone wants to bring one back, you're more than welcome to.
You'll just bypass passport security and just get a Dole Whip.
Unfortunately, I have enough trouble with security in America as it is, so I don't think that's going to be... and not even alcohol-related either, so, you know.
The reason we have asked Nick to come on is these two parts of the Disney community, us being the Mini Minxes and them being Disaster Dart, have come together to discuss the, what can I say, the lack of adult merchandise in the Disney stores in the UK.
Yeah, no, I think that pretty much hits the nail on the head. That's really what it is. I think it's something that, you know, both our show and your show as well feel quite strongly about. And really, that's why we're trying to kind of make as much public awareness of our cause as we can.
Too right.
I mean, really, I mean, although it was something that I started ranting about on my little soap dishes soapbox segment, it was something really that was spurred by a comment from Kirsten Shaw, who I'm sure you guys are well, who kind of mentioned to me or said, you know, you rant about a lot of things, but I think this is something you should rant about. And it was something that I'd briefly discussed very early on when we started doing the show, but I thought, well, nothing's changed, so maybe we should try and make a bigger stance. And funny enough, when I actually decided to go and have a little rant about it, it wasn't until I was actually halfway through my little speech that I decided we should start a petition. And then, of course, once you say something like that, then you need to do something about it. So, and within about 6 hours of the show going out that week, I had people going, oh, I can't find the link. Well, that's because there wasn't a link at that point. So I was like, all right, people are beating me to the punch. I need to sort something out. So, that was the reason really for starting this petition. So really, you know, hopefully your listeners will agree with the girls and myself and my other co-hosts at Disaster Dart that, you know, something that's sorely lacking at the moment is enough merchandise in Disney stores in the UK and also the US as well. But for adults.
Can I clarify the situation and see what the both of you sort of think, although I know Kim's opinion's fairly well. The Disney store in the US, massive product range on DisneyStore.com. For us in the UK, we have the unfortunate $15 limit. So anything we spend over $15 coming to this country, we will get taxed on, import tax, which is nothing to do with Disney, but we have then very expensive delivery charge, then tax. So really for us, we only, personally, I only use .com when I am absolutely desperate and I know I can't get it from anywhere else.
Sure.
Do you tend to use .com a lot?
There have been instances. We're quite privileged in the fact that we've got some friends over in America that we're able to kind of lean upon when we might need to buy something in the States that won't allow you to ship internationally, and we do the same for them. Obviously, DisneyStore.com do ship internationally, but the actual prices, if anyone does try and buy anything, are quite outstanding. I think... if you order a single Vinylmation, and we all know how big a Vinylmation is, it's probably about $15 or $20 to have it shipped. It actually costs more to have one of those ship than it will do to actually buy it in the first place. So I do use .com, but try and make sure that it's either really small things or it's things that I can get sent to somebody and then sent on. And it's ridiculous, really. You sometimes will end up paying for shipping twice because you have to get it shipped into an address in the US and then shipped back out to you. But that's still cheaper than getting it shipped directly from DCStore.com in the first place. So it's kind of crazy the hoops you have to jump through. But like you say, that the range they have on DCStore.com is so incredibly vast compared to what we get in the UK that you do see things and just think, well, I'm never going to be able to get that here. So
it is awkward, even if you'd get to go over and visit in person. We only have a limited amount of luggage allowance to bring the things back anyway. So it's like, well, do I just take it? Do I just put up with the cost? Because obviously in the US, you're ordering from .com. They quite frequently have offers on with free delivery if you spend over, say, $75.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously that doesn't apply to us in the UK.
No.
So, and I know Kim uses .com via me quite a bit, don't you? And we've been really stung on the shipping and import tax, haven't we, love?
Yeah, most definitely. I'm going to say, I think what I ordered, I can't remember which ones I ordered, but I ended up with, I think, 4 or 5. And I think after I'd paid everything for them, custom charges and delivery charges, this, that, and stuff, it worked out at £11 per vinyl mation, which is obviously a little bit more than what we pay for them over here, but they were designs that I would never get over here in a million years.
And the thing is, you know, on eBay, you're going to pay a premium anyway.
Yeah.
So even when you know, say you paid $8 for it on eBay, by the time you've actually got it shipped over here, you're still going to end up paying about the same kind of cost anyway. So, you know, you're still quids in, because like you're saying, you're not going to be able to buy it here. So you've got to buy it one way or another. It's just quite frustrating that you have to go through these hoops to be able to do that. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, Vinylmation is obviously a big love of mine, but it's not just that. When I talk about the adult things, it annoys me when you go to the theme parks and you're able to get all kinds of manner of shirts, ties, accessories, jewellery, all of these kind of things, and yet you walk into a Disney store in the UK and you're just met with a wall of whatever latest films, cuddly toys are, or merchandise for that.
Mm-hmm.
The wall of things for babies, and that takes up most of the store, and kids' clothes as well. And then you get this little section that sells things like DVDs, maybe a few animations if you're lucky, key rings, that kind of thing. And for winter, they normally get some adult-sized pyjamas, and that's your Disney store. And, you know, when you go to a Disney park, and I mean, yes, all right, I understand it's a park, but surely the same people are shopping in a Disney park as I would be in a Disney store.
Well,
but it doesn't make you want to go in.
No, you're exactly right. It doesn't. And I think I touched on this on the episode that we did when I had a bit of a rant about it. And I'm not going to try and rant too much because I ranted quite a lot on that episode. But it wasn't so long ago where you could purchase adult items from the Disney store before they had this latest refit. I seem to remember that, you know, you could get quite a lot of the snow globes and you could get quite a lot of the ornaments and you could get kitchenware. You know, I bought, silverware, cutlery silverware from there. I bought, you know, a dinner set from there, you know, cereal bowls, cups, you know, tea towels, you know, and you could, you know, I think I even got some, a couple of t-shirts in a bigger size in there once. And it just seems to be after this latest refit, and this is what Michelle says quite often, is they now seem to class themselves as a toy shop, which I think's wrong.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think the problem is now is that the stores over here had the same identity as they do in America. And so when I first started this and I assumed it was just, you know, going from like the .com website, I assumed that the problem was purely down to us just being in England and having a less selection. But it does appear that the stores in the US are almost identical to the ones in the UK. And it's almost like the identity has been broken, because now everything is completely uniform. It's like, you know, going into McDonald's. If you go into the McDonald's in England, you go into a McDonald's in America, you might have a few different menu choices that are different. But if you order a Big Mac, it will taste exactly the same. Yeah. Because that's how they want things to be. And it's quite clear that the Disney store have gone, this is what we want our stores to look like now. We're going to refit them all. And this is what we want to sell. And they're doing so. Now, I went to the flagship store a few weeks ago. And they do have some of the kitchenware that you were talking about. Things like spatulas and pizza cutters, yeah, and that kind of thing. Which you can also get at the parks. And they had a few mugs and bowls, but I mean, it was like odd bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. But the one in Oxford Street, the big one they used to have in Oxford Street, had like big glass cabinets full of snow globes, all different types of snow globes at various prices. You was able to get like things like tires and shirts and clothes like that. So it's not like they've never done them. It just seems to be that they've decided that they don't want to go for the adult market anymore.
Yeah.
And when you've got a store, I mean, the thing is, I understand it more with the smaller stores. We have like a couple of stores in shopping centres near to where we live, and both of them, one of them does a small range of animations, the other one doesn't do any at all. They're both quite big, but they're not massive. But when you go to London and you go to the flagship store, it's on two levels. I mean, I can't understand that in two levels, all you can get for adults is a small range of kitchen utensils, some bowls and mugs, and also a couple of the Jim Shaw Disney Traditions series of statues. And, like, they literally had three different types of a range. You could go into an H. Samuels or another jeweller's like that and get a bigger range of those statues than you can there. And, frankly, I think that's quite embarrassing.
It is. It's not good enough at all. But even not to provide the service where you can order it from the internet and have it delivered into the store, they don't even offer to do that. And that, for me, would be a compromise that I can cope with, because I can not have to pay the delivery cost and I can check it out visually before I purchase.
Yeah. And the fact is, it's sent from a warehouse. So, it's, you know, the thing is, if their argument was, well, you know, we want the stores themselves to focus more on child ranges of clothes and toys and stuff like that, that's fine. But there's, you know, then they can say, but if you want like a big range of adult stuff, visit the website. But when you go on there, there is a range on there. We're not saying that there's nothing, but there's just simply is not enough. And surely if you've got giant warehouses anyway, you can store more stuff. So I don't understand why they can't get things in and do them. They've proved before that when they get, you know, new series of Funimations at the same time as America, they fly out.
Yeah.
They don't sit on the website for ages and ages. When you've got a new series which has just come out in America at the same time as the UK, they sell out. When you get a series in which is 6 months after the American release date, well, everyone that wants them has bought them from America, whether it's via eBay or from DisneyStore.com. So the thing is, that's when they then find this merchandise sitting on the shelves. There is a balance they've got to do, but I do think that they really need to try and focus more on the .co.uk presence, if that's what they're going to do and not going to change things in the stores. To be honest, I'd be happy with either result. All I want at the end of the day is a choice for adults. I think it's what we all want. And the idea, hopefully, is that, you know, by people signing this petition and adding your names to it, we're not going to, it's never going to generate hundreds of thousands of names, probably won't even generate thousands. But if you can show that there's a market there, it might make them think, you know what, maybe we should, maybe we're not looking at this the right way. Maybe we should try and consider doing more things, even as like a .co.uk exclusive, just so there's a range there, there's an opportunity for adults to buy things. But at the same time, it's not, at the moment, walking into a Disney store as an adult, if you don't have children, is not a pleasurable experience.
No. You know, at the end of the day, I'm the person who works really, really hard in my family. I bring in the money, and I like to wear my Disney clothes. I like to have a Disney dinner service for when people come round for dinner, but to get these things is so difficult.
The annoying thing is, we're not here discussing, wouldn't it be good if Disney did adult things like that? Disney do these things. They're available at the parks and they're available in America. They're just not available here. Mm. And that's really what they need to try and address.
So, right. And, you know, the issue before about floor space, some of these things are quite small that they could start stocking. For example, some of the jewellery ranges. I was paying $30 for some most amazing Swarovski crystal style necklaces.
Mm.
They don't take up much space.
No.
You know, little things like that would make so much difference to the adult Disney fan who doesn't necessarily want the T-shirt. You know, I bought some fleeces, I bought some hoodies, I bought some bracelets, I bought all sorts of different bits and pieces from the different ranges. It just nice to buy it at the store. So, I signed the petition.
Thank you.
How can our listeners sign the petition?
Well, there's a few links. The one that always rolls off the tongue for me, because it's the one that I have to give out the most, is www.tisafterdark.com/petition. And it kind of leads you to a little brief description of what the petition is and how to sign it. It literally takes about 20 seconds. So it's not saying it will take you a long period of time to do. The aim is to run it for about another month or so, try and get as many names as possible, and then kind of take it to head office. And hopefully we'll see if something can be done. Speaking to head office before, they do seem to be quite receptive to ideas, but I think, you know, just a few lonely voices saying things and, you know, are you going to sell this? Would you consider selling that? We'd like to see this in stores, like to see this online, isn't going to make them change their mind. But, you know, if we can get a list of people that all say, you know, we're interested, we want this to happen, you know, consider us as well. Because like you said before, at the end of the day, we're the ones that have the money.
Yeah.
You know, your kids don't have money. They don't walk in there and buy things. They will say to you, I want this, I want that. But you're the one that's going to part with your cash. So it's important that they cater for us as well.
Definitely. And we're not going to go into a shop where we feel uncomfortable because it doesn't cater to us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think that, and I'd like to think that if we could get the volume of both of our listeners and other shows, if they sort of come on board with it as well, if we could get quite a lot of people to sign the petition. We're not sort of complaining, we're just sort of, you know, pointing out the fact that we'd like a larger range and we'd like a more variety range. I honestly, hopefully, do think there's a good chance that they might listen, if we can get the figures.
The problem is, you know, in this country, we are very good at moaning and complaining about things, but normally to each other. You know, I'm sure this is a conversation that you'd had with Michelle before.
Yeah.
I'd had this conversation with people that I'd spoken to that came over dinner, that kind of thing, and with Disney fans, and we all said the same kind of thing, that, you know, it's terrible. So the thing is, we're quick enough to moan about these things, but the only way we can get things to change is by letting them know how we feel. And so it's not about being rude or anything like that, because that gets you nowhere. But if you can, you know, show that there is a market there for them to consider, then, you know, hopefully that will be enough to let it happen. So we'll see.
Fantastic stuff. Well, thank you for joining us. Sharing
where
we can all get involved. It literally does take 20 seconds. So please, you know, please sign it. Please support this and something he's done about it.
Yes, that's it.
Just in case any of our listeners haven't listened to Diz After Dark, Nick, do you want to just plug it? Because I'm sure Paul would never let me live it down if we didn't let you plug Diz After Dark.
Yeah, it'd probably kick me off the show, actually. Diz After Dark, it's I'd say a more adult-based podcast. We used to be quite famous for drinking and being a bit rude, but we've toned it down now to make it a bit more family-orientated. But basically, it's three guys sitting in a makeshift pub, having a drink and talking about all things Disney. I occasionally get a bit mad about something and will let my feelings know, like I've done with this. It's just a chance for us to kind of chill out and kick back. And hopefully make people laugh. The worst thing about it probably is the fact that when I listen back to it, I laugh at myself telling jokes. So that's a good thing or a bad thing, or I should be owning up to it. But no, and you know, we're fans of your show. As yours is a girly show, and ours is a bit more of a blokey orientated show, or blokey even. Not what I just said then. But yeah, so anyone who wants to give us a try, we're on iTunes as well, or after you sign a petition, download a show. Thank you ever so much for having me on.
No, you're and, welcome.
Let's hope that together we can make a difference.
Aww.
Oh, we need some sort of theme tune now, isn't it? Theme tune. Together we will make a difference.
See, why do you need a theme tune when you've got it a cappella?
Oh my god, the chocolate milkshake sugar attack is happening, Nick.
Oh, I did wonder. I didn't want to say anything.
Oh dear, I best go and rest my little head.
Here's some more fun, starring yours truly.
Every locked door holds something behind it. What if you have the key? Are you ready to unlock the kingdom? Well, to help Kim and myself this evening, we have the author, Jeff Dixon, of The Key to the Kingdom. Good evening, Jeff.
Good evening. I'm glad to be with you.
I'm very grateful of you agreeing to come on the show and sharing a little bit about this book and about yourself. Now, can I just clarify, do I need to give you your Sunday name of Jeffrey, or is it Jeff?
Jeff is great.
Fantastic. just need to check there, you see, Kim's a Kim, or sometimes she's Kimmy, she can't make her mind up.
I can't make my mind up, but welcome Jeff to the Mini Minxes.
I'm honoured to be with you, it's going to be fun.
Yay! Honorary Minx for the evening while we have a little chat. Fantastic stuff. So, before we get on to talking about your book and a little bit more about what's coming in the future from you, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about yourself, because I gather you were raised in Florida, is that true?
I am. I am actually one of the people that you could meet over the course of your lifetime that was actually born and raised in Orlando, Florida. And I was here before Disney ever arrived, and I can remember Orlando, you know, pre-Magic Kingdom, and I remember, of course, having the opportunity to kind of watch the changes as it all unfolded and the excitement of that, and of course got to live here again as an adult and raise my family here. So I'm Orlando proud, and I'm one of the few natives that are left, I think.
Oh my God.
I am so jealous.
That's amazing. I can't imagine being there before the whole Disney phenomenon and actually being there over the whole build-up of it all. I mean, that must have been incredible.
It was. I actually remember as a child getting the opportunity to go to the Disney Preview Center, which is out there on Hotel Boulevard now, where the AAU building is, right there at the Village. But they just had this big preview center where we could go in and look at models of what the park was going to look like and see the film and hear Walt talking about the Florida project. And I remember as a kid just thinking, there's just no way they're going to build this here. It's not going to be this cool. And then getting the opportunity to actually go into a preview before the park opened to the public with my family, and having my dad take me in so I could look around, and just it was bigger and better than I ever thought it would be. And I think from that moment on, as a kid, I was hooked. I was going to be a Disney fan forever.
It's really hard to comprehend with Orlando being such a mega massive place now. What was it like before Disney hit? What sort of size was the community?
It was really small. As a matter of fact, it was in the middle of, I mean, from my perspective as a kid, it was in the middle of nowhere, and it took forever to drive from my house in Orlando to get there. And of course, now to now, anybody that's been there knows how it's just all developed in Orlando and Central Florida. It's just one big massive area for, you know, nearly 65, 70 miles as you cut across the interstate. But I mean, there was nothing there. It was a small community. It was a rural community. They did a, you know, just a lot of farming. There wasn't a lot of business out there, and everything was just orange groves and just undeveloped land, which of course is why Walt picked up the land like he did and was able to get it so cheap.
Yeah. Wow. So does your family then have some early photographic history of Orlando's development?
We do. We have some very interesting pictures, I think, of us as a family going in with me as a kid wearing a set of mouse ears, and I had a younger sister as well. And so, oh, yeah, we went in just like everybody else, big tourist, and just having a great time, just thinking that this was there was never going to be anything else like this, and had no idea that in years ahead, you know, there would be Epcot. You know, that would be MGM or now Hollywood Studios, and the Animal Kingdom would come behind it. Had, you know, just no concept of how big it would ultimately be. But those were great days. It was a lot of fun.
What was the atmosphere like within the community then, while this was all in its sort of early stages? Was it quite a positive reaction from the community?
It really was. I mean, I know that there are some books out there that have been written that talk about, you know, the sweet deal that Walt got with the state of Florida. And he did get a sweet deal, no doubt about it. But my dad was employed by the city of Orlando. And so we got to hear a lot of the stories about what was kind of going on behind the scenes as Disney was coming to town. And the anticipating the excitement, I mean, and had it not been for Walt and bringing in, you know, this dream, this idea. I mean, Orlando, as we know it, as the tourist destination for the entire world, and a lot of the businesses and the development that came as a result of Disney coming in, it never would have taken place. I mean, Orlando was a beautiful community before, and it was real pretty. They called it the City Beautiful then, and they still do. But I mean, the explosive growth really is tied to that property that Walt bought, that original dream that was out there. I mean, that really has been the big boom for Orlando and changed everything. I mean, it just changed the lives of people forever.
Wow. Oh, I'm just in awe now. I just can't imagine it.
You can't, can you? You just can't comprehend it. I mean, that just shows that shallow tourists we are, but you just can't comprehend Orlando without Walt Disney World.
And it's funny because even as a kid growing up, I mean, I remember that one of the things that even I was thinking about as I grew up, it would be that, okay, one day when it's time, I'll get a job. I probably could get a job at Disney World. And sure enough, one of the first jobs I had was at Walt Disney World, just like a lot of other kids that grew up in Orlando. I mean, that's what they did. It was not uncommon at all. And back in those days, there was only one theme park. It was Magic Kingdom. But we, you know, we would go out there. And of course, you know, Disney was a great provider of jobs, just like it is today. And what a great place to work. What a great environment. You got to be a cast member, and it was fun. And you get to meet people from all over the world. And you know, so again, it was Disney coming in and bringing Walt Disney World here really opened up the whole world to Central Florida. And Central Florida is a great place. There's no doubt about it. So I hope the benefits have been for everyone. I hope it works both ways.
Super. Now, obviously, you've just said that you had a calling from the mouse to go and work for the mouse. I gather after that you got a calling from somebody else to go down a different route by working and studying at a seminary in Texas. Is that right as well?
I did. I was called as a young kid to work for a little while at the mouse and had a great time out there. And then also, after I graduated from college, went on to Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth, Texas, and picked up my graduate degree and my job when I'm not doing a lot of other things is I'm a full-time pastor, and I get to be the pastor of a great innovative church in Central Florida that that I just love being at, that allows me the freedom to be creative and to share what I think is just incredible news about how people's lives can improve and be better. And you talk about the love of God. And then again, they give me the freedom to chase my passion for Disney. And I always laugh and tell people, I said, well, you know, if we could get a little glimpse of heaven, it might be Disney World. And of course, some people laugh at me if they love it. And then some people go, well, you gotta be kidding me, because they don't like the crowds. But one way or the other, it's okay.
Oh, my heavens. So, You went over to Texas. Was the plan always to go back to Florida?
It really wasn't. I didn't know when I was in Texas where I was going to end up. I served at a church in Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then came back to a church in South Florida. So I spent some time down in the West Palm Beach area, had an office like two blocks from the beach, and loved that. And then eventually got back into the Central Florida area. And once I made it back into the area, I'd been back in the Orlando area, very close to where I grew up. And been here for nearly 25 years now. So, I mean, I've kind of gone full circle and made the loop and got to travel a lot and do a lot of things. But I really am one of those people that it doesn't matter in spite of the growth or the weather or the hurricanes or whatever might come along. I love where I live. I mean, I love living in Central Florida. I just think it's a great place.
It is. It's a beautiful place. Absolutely gorgeous. Apart from when it's raining or you're getting visited by tropical storm Isaac.
Yes, that can change a vacation plan. That can change the way that the whole city operates. But you know, they come through, and we've been very fortunate and blessed too. We've been hit a few times, but not as often as people might think. So we're okay.
Yeah, and I must say, Kim, between us Brits and I think the native Floridians, we must be the only people that just go about our business around the theme parks wearing our raincoats while all the other tourists hide out in little stalls and shops and things. Because, you know, it's raining. So what? I can just wander around. I'm prepared. I've got a rain mac. Are you the same, Kim? Mm-hmm.
Well, sort of, apart from the fact that I kind of think, well, I've just spent nearly 10 grand coming on this holiday. I'm not going to go stand in the shop while it's raining. I'm going to get my money's worth.
Well, you know, but you say that, but one of my favorite places to be in the rain is Disney World, because when it rains, people do exactly what you just said. They go hide in their shops, they go back to the hotels, they go and duck for cover. And when it's raining, the lines get short. You can move about a lot easier. You can see things in the rain that you might not normally get to see. And here, you know, for an insider's tip, if you live in Orlando and a hurricane's coming, you want to make reservations at Walt Disney World. Because when we've had storms in town where I've actually been in my house and been without power for 3 or 4 weeks at a time, Disney doesn't lose power. And so when my home had no lights, no electricity, all the food in my refrigerator was rotting because of a storm, and there was nothing to do except sit in the dark, we were out at the theme parks playing and having a great time, taking a mini vacation. I mean, we knew we had to clean up, you know, fallen trees and stuff when we got back to the house. But, you know, in the meantime, we had power, and it was good. We'd always wait till the power comes back on to go back home.
Oh, you see, you need my husband. He's a backup power specialist. And he would work for a company in the States such as Disney to ensure they're never without power. So
yeah, oh, they do a great job. I mean, and even the Disney cast that work so hard. I mean, you know, and you think about their jobs, and they have to leave their homes in a storm to go in and make sure that the guest experience is still good when they're worried about, you know, their houses falling apart or getting blown over and things like that. So, I mean, it's a different place during a tropical storm, but in a normal rainstorm, I mean, Disney, I think, is a lot of fun. I mean, it just really is a lot of fun to walk around in the rain and wear your poncho and just take it all in.
So when you moved back then, Jeff, when did the idea about writing come about?
As a pastor, one of the things that I've always done is tried to incorporate stories into sermons or Bible studies, and always been in front of people where I was actually speaking and being able to tell what I think is a fabulous story and stories out of the Bible. But along the way, because we had some success as a church and a ministry, I was invited to write for some periodicals. I could write for some magazines, and so I spent some time writing some things that were very much church specific. I mean, I was writing for a church crowd and articles about, you know, how to be a better pastor and, you know, how to teach better studies, write better sermons and things like that. But somewhere along the line, you know, I just had this sense that maybe I could tell a story, and maybe it could take shape in a way that I never thought before. And I spent a lot of time just kind of dabbling at it, and I actually have a couple of stories that I started to write for a while that you know, I would write them, and they never, you know, they just never really kind of came together. But I just kind of kept at it. I kind of learned the craft a little bit and tried to learn how to do it and how to piece a story together, because it's radically different than what I do every week. And so it just became a hobby. I never really thought about a book that would be related to Disney until I had a real life experience that I kind of wrote into the book that became really kind of the jumping point for this idea that said, you know what, that would make a good story. I bet I could run with that. And sure enough, the novel came together. I found a publisher in Deep River Publishing that was just fantastic. They signed me to a contract, and I was able to get the book out. And from there, I mean, Disney fans have been great, and they've embraced it. And so it's been a fun ride. And you know, again, I just really enjoy it. It's just something new and different. I call it a hobby, and I do it on the side. And but I really enjoyed it.
So, did you have a target market, like a particular age group or anything in mind when you started planning?
I think I did. I you know, I'm a Disney fan. There's no doubt about it. I mean, just a huge Disney fan. And so for me, I wanted to write a book that I would like to read. So I decided from the get-go that I was really going to kind of write for people who had just a fondness for Disney, who I tried to write that kind of story that says, you know, this is going to be unbelievable. It's going to be just way over the top. It's going to be almost like a Disney story for adults. And what I found is, you know, that really from teenage up, I mean, I've had good response from audiences, and so, because there's nothing in the book that's objectionable, or, you know, that if your kids read it, they're going to make you blush or anything like that. But it really is kind of one of those adult stories where you just kind of read it and just go, you know what, this would be so cool if it happened to me. And that's kind of how I got into it. I'm like, oh, I'd love it if this were really happening to me right now. This would be fantastic. And so that's kind of how it came together. It was a book that was kind of just written for a target audience of a Disney fan who's an adult who just doesn't want to quite grow up yet.
That's definitely me. I'm not ready to grow up. And I think that's Kim as well, isn't it, love?
Most definitely, yeah.
So it's described as an adventure book as... it's factual fiction. Did you always have in your mind that it was going to be a bit of an adventure book?
I did. I wanted, to me, one of the things that's so fascinating about Disney is the details that they hide in the park, that they kind of just wrinkle into the backdrop that a lot of times if you're visiting a Disney theme park, you never take the time to notice some of the intricate details that are there. But if you do stop and notice, or you really start paying attention to what you might see, you know, there's almost like a whole nother theme park hidden within the theme park. And I wanted to kind of take those ideas and develop just an adventure mystery that would put the lead characters on this incredible quest to find out you know, a secret that Walt himself had kind of put in place. And so it really wasn't that difficult to do as far as, you know, weaving it together. And so when I call it factual fiction, I mean, it definitely is a work of fiction, and it's popped out of my head somewhere. But it's also the kind of thing where people have taken the book to the theme parks, and I've actually gotten pictures from folks who have gone out there with the book, and they go find the clues that are in the book. And they can actually go, and so for some people on their vacations, and again, I'm very flattered when I hear that they said, we took your book in and we took some time to look up some of the stuff that you put in the book because we just wanted to see if we could find it. And they can, and so that was very gratifying to me as well, because that's really what I did. I mean, if you're going to write a book and you want to make it factual fiction, you know, write it about Disney because it gives you a good reason to go to the theme park. And so... I just call it research, but I go to the theme park almost every day just to have some fun and look around. So
we like that kind of research, don't we, Kim?
Yeah, it's good. Definitely.
Yeah, well, it definitely does do something which is quite rare with a lot of books, is that it does definitely engage both sexes. It's something that male-female readers could pick up and enjoy straight away, which I know from my perspective over here in the UK, there is a big issue with boys not seeing it being cool to read. But if a particular boy has an interest in Disney, this would make an absolute excellent read for him to, you know, to do. And as you say, engage him at the park while he's waiting in lines. Let's see what park might match up with where I am now.
Sure. And one of the things, too, when I wrote the book, I mean, as I started, I mean, again, I had never written a novel. And so and this really was my first attempt at a novel that was published. And I had to learn a lot along the way. And again, my publisher was great. And the editing staff I worked with was fantastic. And it really did help me develop some of those characters in such a way where there's an element of that you know, big adventure, and it's fun, and there's some mystery. But, you know, there's a bit of romance in there, and trying to write that into the book a little bit too, because again, the idea was let's try to make the story appeal to folks who just have various interests, but really are all tied together because they really do love a good mystery, and they love Disney, and see what that looks like. And I think on some levels we did that. I mean, I'm pleased. I mean, you look back at it now and you say, you know, gosh, I wish I could have done this, or I wish I could have done this. But, you know, I wasn't writing War and Peace. I was really just trying to write a book that was a lot of fun. And so I think we nailed that, though. I mean, I think we were able to kind of capture just a real sense of just, you know, just a good time and a fun romp through a theme park, like riding a ride. And when it's over with, you go, man, I wish I could write it again. Or I wish it wasn't over yet. And that's what I wanted to get to at the end.
Now, seeing as my copy is still in Michelle's unpacked suitcase, she has hinted to me about bits and pieces of the book. And one thing that she sort of hinted was is the book is described as being fact with a sprinkle of fiction. How much would you say is fiction, Jeff?
Well, I think the premise of the story itself, it really is fiction. And then what I did is I took that fictional story and I dropped the story into very real factual settings and places. And so, you know, one of the things that happened right after the book came out is I would get a lot of email. And the questions were always like, you wrote about this. Is this real? You wrote about this place. Is it real? You wrote that I could find this. Could I really go find this? And the answer to at least 90% of those questions is yes. I mean, there are certainly some times that, you know, I had to create some things to kind of drive the story and make it work. But, you know, so, I mean, you know, the premise in the story is certainly fiction. You know, there's a bit of parody to it because, you know, I'm writing about an imagined future that's fun and kind of a spin on the future of Disney and things like that. So I mean, there's a great sense of that, but it's a true fan book from the standpoint that the places in it are very real, and I got to use that as a nice backdrop to paint against. And so I think that, I think that the balance is there, and I think for a Disney fan, it is a lot of fun to go in and be able to look at those real places and go, I know exactly where he's talking about. Or try to even figure out the clue before the character in the book does, which some people, you know, some people said they did, and that's great, and some people said, I never would have figured that out. How did you come up with that? And, you know, again, there's a lot of trips to Disney will do that for you.
And I gather that you've actually gone to the trouble of putting a picture up about Gamble House, haven't you? Because people kept asking you about, is it real? Does it exist?
Yeah, that was one of the neat things that I got a chance to do. And when I heard about the Gamble House, I heard about it, and when it was presented to me as a urban legend, a place that someone had heard of, didn't really exist. And I actually saw an article about it in a book called Weird Florida, which is a series of books that was just written about all the weird, off the beaten path places that you can find that, you know, are hidden in various states over here. And so I went one day and jumped in my car and went to see if I could find it. And when I got there, what happened is I got there, and the story that's in the book about how the lead character kind of discovers it for the very first time is very similar to what I did. I mean, I did find it and was able to climb over a fence and look around a little bit and do a little snooping around. And again, was not, I mean, it was a place that apparently was under construction because the state of Florida had finally grabbed it as a historical site. And so I actually got to be there as they were kind of cleaning up the park that it's in now and some things like that. So I actually got a private tour of the house, and I've been there a number of times now, but it really is there. It's really real. And somebody took the time to build a replica of Snow White's cottage there. And it was just one of those fun finds way off the Disney, radar, but for a Disney fan, an amazing place to look at and see.
might have to go and track that down myself, I think. Although I don't...
It's a great field trip. It's a great little trip to go on.
I don't have a lot of luck with finding my way around at the, when I went over this year. For some reason, my sat-nav just went completely bizarre and kept on taking us off going down backstage. And for some reason, we kept on going around cast member parking and the reception area. Do you know what? The number of times I drove past the back of Space Mountain without anyone checking our ID was unbelievable. So,
Yeah.
Anyway, I've got a little bit of an excerpt that I'd just like to read to our listeners to sort of like tantalise them a little bit to see what they think. And this is from the beginning. Bear with me, and hopefully my voice isn't going to totally disappear as I'm reading along. Halogen headlamps pierced the darkness of the cool central Florida night. The GPS guided the Mustang searching toward the coastal community of Port Orange. Racing along Taylor Road, Dr. Grayson Hawks approached an unknown destination. Questions swirled in the tornado of curiosity whipping through the preacher's mind. The glow of the dashboard light illuminated the business card propped up against the gear shift. 1819 Taylor Road, Port Orange, had been neatly printed in blue ink. Flipping the card, he read the name on the other side. Farron Rails, Imagineering Ambassador, Walt Disney Company. I'm not going to read any more. I'm going to write it now. I'm not going to say any more. So you've just mentioned, I've just mentioned there two quite key characters. Where did the inspiration for these two people come about from?
Well, Grayson Hawks ends up being the lead character, and he's a preacher. To me, that was not a far stretch. But I always get interested of how people perceive preachers. And I guess because I am one, this made it a little bit easier. But, you know, the preachers I know, I mean, for the most part, are, you know, they're very real people, and they have the same struggles that anybody else does. And I don't know if people always recognize that. And I think that sometimes preachers get some bad stereotypes. And so I really wanted to create a character that kind of had an unusual job and for a lot of people, because you don't usually read a story about a preacher, but also to discover a preacher that's kind of a lot like them. That really likes to have fun, was kind of edgy, really enjoyed life, and also wasn't afraid of a challenge and was up to embrace an adventure that ends up being just a lot bigger than he is. And so, you know, Grayson Hawks kind of jumped from that person. Farron Rails, as an Imagineer, actually was an idea that kind of emerged out of a real-life experience, because one of the things that we do and we've done as a church staff, the staff here at the church that I serve, I said earlier that I really believe that one of my jobs as a preacher is I get to tell the greatest story ever told. And so we met, living here in Central Florida, we have some advantages, and so we actually sat down and met with a Disney Imagineer over lunch. And the idea behind the lunch was, you know, look, Disney is the greatest storyteller of all time. Disney tells stories better than anybody else. And I'm a preacher. And so I believe as a preacher, I'm supposed to do a good job telling the story. People remember the stories that Disney tell. They don't always remember the story that the church is trying to tell. And so I asked him the question, how do I learn to tell the story better? Teach us as a staff how to tell our story better. And so that real life meeting that took place, you know, kind of became this backdrop where I thought, well, you know what? What if I turn that whole scenario into a fictional kind of story? And so this Farron Rails character became a character that kind of developed just out of a real life experience that I had had, where he's an Imagineer that the preacher gets to know because the preacher wants to tell the story a little bit better. And the next thing I know, I'm off and running on a novel. And it really became that spark that set the thing in motion. So when I say it's factual fiction, I mean, again, even that piece of it became a real life experience that became part of the story.
Wow, I've never thought of it from that angle before, but it really makes sense what you've said there. I mean, Michelle hasn't really stopped talking about this book since she sort of read it, and making me even more jealous because I still haven't got my hands on a copy of it. But when I first actually spoke to her after she'd finished reading the book, one of the things she just couldn't get over is your use of Pal Mickey in the book. Are you a fan of Palmaki, and do you actually own one?
Well, I will admit that as I was writing the story, I thought I need a gimmick, something that will help me drive this story forward. And I was trying to think of all these different ways to do it and different pieces of technology, and I had been fascinated with these Palmakis. Sadly, my children were too old to just buy one for no reason. And then it dawned on me, you know what? Hey, I need to buy one of these things so I can figure out how these things work. And so I did. It gave me a great reason to buy a Palmaki. So, yes, I do own a Palmaki. I have been one of those strange-looking adults walking through the park with a stuffed animal, listening to it talk to me and trying to look around to figure out where the different transponders were. And you know, so, yeah, I was that guy, I guess. But yeah, what a neat little gimmick and great piece of technology that they created, and a lot of fun. And so I do own one. It sits on my shelf now. I've officially retired him. So I don't take him to the park anymore now that the book is written. But yes, Palmaki became a very important cog in the story.
Well, with the way things are going with the technology and the use of the iPhone and other smartphones, they're really now sort of the new, if you like, Palmakis, because you've got the Mobile Magic app from Disney, and you've got all the Wi-Fi in the parks, and you know, the promise of maybe being able to do your fast passes from your phone and make ADRs, sure, etc. So I suppose it's just a reinventation of Palmaki without it being as cuddly and cute, really.
It is. I mean, in the way that I used the Palmaki in the story was, you know, I said that, you know, there was a very unique Palmaki and there had been some technologies developed just for it. But you're absolutely right. I think that was really the, you know, the kind of the test toy and the test case to see if they could pull off some of these amazing things they're doing now. And I love the technology in the park. I mean, I think that the way they're using it, and even at Epcot right now, the, you know, that Agent P, Phineas and Ferb adventure that's going on out there, where you kind of use that technology and you kind of go on this, you know, again, solving this mystery with those Phineas and Ferb characters, which are great, by the way. I think it can enhance a guest trip to the park. And if that's what it's all about, I mean, if you want someone to go and have a great time, why not put as many tools in their hand as possible to, you know, if that's something you like, then it's going to be available to you. So I think it's fun.
Yeah. Are you a fan of Sorcerers of the Magic Kingdom then?
Believe it or not, I like that. I do like that. And I actually have a young man here in the church who was kind enough to kind of give me a crash course on how that worked. So we went out there one day, and he helped me get my cards, and he'd already done it before, so he was a veteran. I was the old guy that didn't know what he was doing. You know, I was trying to keep up with the technology. And so he actually kind of took me around from place to place and showed me, and we were solving clues and kind of moving forward. I mean, and it's a kick. It's great. And I was amazed at the lines of people waiting to do it.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's fun. And that's something else, that when it starts to rain, there's never a line for that. People run.
It is so, so addictive. And yet it's just another way of using technology to engage people in the park. And to be honest, Kim, and you've not probably seen this, there are just as many adults waiting at the portals to play the game as there are children, which I was quite surprised by. But once I played it, I realised why. I am so addicted. I've got to go back and get some more cards. I found myself going to whatever park I was going, but I had to go to Magic Kingdom every day to get a new pack of cards.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very bad. Anyway, I'm digressing onto a totally different podcast there. In the book, you made a link to Walt's plane. Now, obviously, to the Florida Pod project, Walt's plane was quite a key vehicle for him to be able to travel over from California over, and his executives to spot the right place. There's a lovely little story. Without giving too much away from the book, would you just like to share that with our listeners now about the plane?
Yeah, I mean, the plane is actually on display in Hollywood Studios, and it's a plane that they retired that Walt used as he explored that undeveloped land in Florida. And Of course, the call letters. I mean, for the plane, or the call name for the plane, it was always just known as Mouse One, or Mickey Mouse 234. I mean, there's all sorts of different tags they put on it. But when you hear that line that it was all started by a mouse, well, that was really the mouse that started the development in Central Florida. I mean, that was the plane that Walt was in. But as you think about that, I mean, can you imagine what it was like? And according to the stories that have been told, Dale, as Walt circled and kind of looked out the window of the plane, I mean, he looks out the window of the plane, and as he's looking down on this undeveloped land one day, he kind of turns back to the people that are on board with him, and he goes, you know, I think this will do it. And that one line, that one phrase, changed everything. I mean, we talked earlier about the development in Central Florida. I mean, what if Walt would have looked out the window and said, this isn't going to work? I mean, at that moment, there's no Disney World, there's no development like that happened in Orlando. I mean, nothing changed in that area. And so you start thinking about, man, how important is it, the things that you say, the power of words, that one line, and it's like a blow-off line. It's like you're just throwing a line out. I think this will do it. But the moment he said that, it put in motion a series of events that had you here on vacation, that gave me my first job, that caused me later to write a book. I mean, gave me a place that I could take my kids on the weekends and just, have the experiences that we remember for a lifetime. Simple words. And so all of them were started inside that plane, which I think that plane is so cool and such an important part of Disney history. And yet a lot of people miss it. They don't even realize where it's at, or they don't take the time to look at it.
Mm. And it makes me really, really giddy when I drive past it on the back lot and go, this is the plane! This is the plane! It's not like going over to Disneyland where Walt actually stepped in to the park. He didn't do that over at Walt Disney World. So to actually have that connection with things that belong to Walt there that you can see, and especially in like One Man's Dream, it just makes it all... Sorry.
Yeah. And I think, and for me too, that's one of the things about the Walt Disney World that really just makes it so much more. I don't know. I don't want to use the word bigger, but much more special, because this is that kind of thing where the people who love Walt, especially his brother, really was able to take his vision and his dream and really honor him by creating something that was far bigger than I think that maybe even Walt visualized at the time. And I mean, I think that's just a great testimony to his ability to cast vision, inspire people to tell a story, and to impact lives. And I think, for me, that's one of those things that I think is just very important. I think that, when we're done living life, hopefully our lives have not been, lived selfishly, but that we've really impacted the lives of others. And certainly Walt is one of those characters in history that did just that. I mean, he's a real person that his life just rippled through and continues to touch the lives of people today. And I mean, how valuable is that? How amazing is that? I think it's exciting.
Sure is.
Oh, definitely exciting. Michelle, I'm going to have to keep referring to Michelle said this, Michelle said that. So sorry about this, Jeff. But she also saw
how many books Kim has got in her Disney collection, and she's always buying new books, and she's between doing the podcast and working, breathing and eating, she doesn't have much time to read. So I did get to it in Florida, so I've told her end of September she's got to have this book ready for the next one. So anyway, I'll shut up. Yeah.
Next one, that's exactly what I was going to say. She's mentioned, because I have a week off work, so don't worry, I will get that book read in that week. She's okay. Mentioned that there is a sequel, or is it a prequel, or there is another book coming. Is it related to this book, or is it different? Does it have the same characters?
It is indeed a sequel to this book. When I got to the end of the first one, I really did think it was pretty much one and done. I'd never written a book before. I guess there's a big fear when you're done writing a book, because you always wonder, well, I've written it, I like it, will anyone else ever read it? And in this particular case, people have read it. And Deep River Publishing is a small publishing house. And so, as an unknown author, they were willing to take a chance on me and give me the opportunity to write. And so as the book came out, nobody was really looking for it outside of my family. And so after the folks that I know that I call family, and then my friends here at church, my church family, they all got copies of it. I thought maybe that was it. Maybe that's all that would ever see it. But as the days went by, and really now for the past 2 years, people have found it, they've grabbed it, it's continuing to sell, sales continue to go up, which has been really exciting. So in a lot of ways, it's still kind of like a new release because more and more people are finding it. And folks like yourselves that are just so gracious and kind in allowing me to talk about the book, you know, have really helped that along. And so about a year ago, the question came up, you know, is there a sequel to this book? I mean, does the story of Grayson Hawks and his friends end, or is there more? And I started kind of thinking about it and throwing some ideas around, and sure enough, the idea that was there and the idea I came up with, I tossed it back to the publisher. They liked it immediately, and they said, by all means, let's do it. And so the next thing I know, we've signed another contract, and within just a couple of months, the book is written. Where we are today as we're recording this podcast, it is done. And it is going to be coming out November 20th. And so just in time for Christmas, and I'm very excited about that. And and the first book is going into another printing where at the end of the first book, you can actually see the cover artwork for the sequel that's called Unlocking the Kingdom, as well as the first chapter of the new book. And so anybody that starts picking up the first book in the days ahead will kind of get a preview or a sneak peek at the new book. And so, again, a lot of fun. Same characters come back, plus some new ones. And it's a lot bigger and a lot bolder and a lot more action than the first book. So I'm very excited about people getting a chance to look at it.
Forget wanting it for Christmas. I'll be wanting it 20th of November.
Yeah, see, just in time. And I love it. That's all marketing at that point. That's the publisher's brilliant idea. I'm good with that, too. That's exciting for me, too. So.
So, book two is on its way out. Book three?
Possibly, believe it or not. As soon as book two is done, the question was asked somewhere in that editing process. You know, there's a third one in this one, isn't there? And sure enough, there may be. So we'll see. A lot will depend on how well the second one does. But there is an idea that's a brewing for the third one, and I think that's it. I think that I think it will be three, and I think we can put this series to rest in three books. But it's turned into like a big saga. But a lot of fun, and each book, of course, is a standalone book. But I think that people who especially like Disney are really going to enjoy the fun that the characters have in the park and some of the new stuff that there is to discover. And in the second book, very similar to this Gamble House, where Gamble Place, where Snow White's house or Snow White's cottage is located, I found out the more research I've done that Disney had a lot of ties to Florida long before Walt Disney World ever was developed, and not just that he was here a number of times, but there's some family connections that he has in Florida. So in the new book, one of the things that I really build upon is a lot of that Disney family history, which is very factual, but just also some of the stuff that a lot of Disney fans just don't know. And so I take them to some places in the second book that are here that you can go find if you're in the state of Florida, that are off the beaten path again, that again are just kind of hidden Disney mysteries and Disney secrets that if you really are a Disney nut, is going to be right up people's alley. And of course, I'm mixing a lot of action in the theme parks as well. So I hope it'll be fun.
Ooh, so when you're the new J.K. Rowling, we can see.
Yeah. I don't think there's any worry about that. She is unique. She's original, and she's phenomenal. So I think I'm just a preacher who writes on the side. But that's okay. I'm having a good time at it.
Well, that's what it's all about, because at the end of the day, you work, but it's fantastic to have something that interests you, that you can share a passion with other people. So, yeah. I love reading the book. I just don't want the third one to come about and end, and that's it. So, I have to savor every word. So, could you then, just really quickly, if possible... Mm-hmm. Just sum up in a brief synopsis the book, what it's about, for those people who haven't yet read it, to entice them to go and have a read.
Sure. Key to the Kingdom is one of those stories that I think if you're a Disney fan or you like adventures and mysteries, is the kind of story that you can pick up and you can actually kind of read yourself into. In other words, with the lead character, I think that you say, you know, what would I do if I was placed in an impossible situation and given an opportunity to make some discoveries that that are unbelievable? What would I do? How would I react? And then you add some tension to it about, your past coming back maybe to haunt you just a little bit, your friends in danger and at risk. And then how far would you go? How far would you push the envelope to keep them safe? And that's the kind of scenario that starts to unfold. And so it puts the reader, I hope, into a situation where they kind of think, well, would I have done that, or would I have made that choice? And hopefully create a little conflict, a little tension, and a lot of adventure along the way. And I think that kind of sums up the first book. I mean, it's a guy's given the key to the kingdom, and he has to figure out what to do with the key. And I guess ultimately he could have decided to do nothing, but it would have been a real short book then. So I'm glad that he hadn't finished it out. So,
yeah, just imagine, okay, right, I'm going to have the key to the kingdom. No one else is there. There's just me. I think my idea would be hijacking the Dole Whip machine, installing it in Cinderella's castle, and spending the night there. I think that could pretty much sum up what I'd like to do.
There's something phenomenal about Dole Whip, isn't there? That's like a little island of heaven on earth. Oh, it has to be.
Definitely. And Cinderella's suite, I just would kill. I'd chop a leg off to go live there just for a night. That's all. I'm not Tom Cruise. I'm just a normal person from Yorkshire in England. But I'd stay there.
And it is absolutely phenomenal what they've done with it, and I can tell you that as I wrote the book and I was able to kind of put some of the storyline together, and I mean, you just mentioned Cinderella Suite. I mean, it was amazing how helpful and how great the Disney cast members really are, because I would just walk up to folks as I was walking around the park and ask them questions, and they were just so generous with information and stories and so many stories that didn't end up in the book that really helped me as I was getting ready to write a sequel to be able to have ideas to build on for that sequel and learn all sorts of just, you know, hidden secrets and stuff that people just miss so easily. That are very much a part of the history and the legend of Walt Disney World. So, so it's just a fun place to be.
Truly is. Well, we normally ask our guests on our podcast a range of rapid-fire questions.
Okay.
So, totally disconnected from what we've previously been talking about. So, Kim, do you want to start?
Certainly. Well, you don't usually let me start. You usually take the first one. You're letting me actually have to do something for once.
Yeah.
These are so hard, these questions. I don't know why. I couldn't answer them.
It's right. Not algebra, love.
Well, I won't be able to answer these questions. Jeff?
Yes?
Which is your favourite park?
A Magic Kingdom.
See, it wasn't that hard, was it?
No. Perfect, that's easy.
Do you have a particular favourite ride?
I do. I am a fan of Pirates of the Caribbean.
I love Pirates of the Caribbean. I love telling people my favourite secret about how it goes down the dip so that you go sort of off stage because of the train track. I love sharing that secret. Mm-hmm. My favorite.
And I love the improvements they did to it as well. I like the Johnny Depp additions to it, the Jack Sparrow pieces of it. I think that's just more fun.
Yeah. Do you like that ride, Kim?
I certainly do, because it's not a roller coaster.
She doesn't like them, but we're not talking about Kim. Go on, next question, Kim.
Where is your favorite place to eat?
My favorite place to eat at Disney is probably not everyone else's favorite, because, you know, they think of the fancy restaurants. I like the Earl of Sandwich.
Don't worry, we're Earl of Sandwich fans.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's great. Every time I'm out there, I try to go there to eat.
Do you have a particular favorite on the menu, or do you try and mix it up a bit?
I'm a pretty simple guy, so this is very unimaginative, but I like to order their grilled cheese and then to get a cup of the tomato soup.
Oh,
and dip the grilled cheese in the tomato soup and eat it.
Oh,
that sounds well nice.
So it's kind of gives you that pizza feel, but I know that may be weird to some, but I think it's fantastic.
Do you know, Jeff, that sounds like a hug in a cup, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. Oh. I think I know the answer to the next question. Doug, okay. Or citrus swirl?
Swirl.
Ooh. You've gone to the orange side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. Kim?
Okay. Fantasmic wishes, illuminations, or spectra magic?
Of illuminations. Don't forget that one. Fantasmic,
I think. Big show. Fun to watch.
Okay. So, at the moment, we're on Main Street Electrical Parade.
Okay.
We're going to be changing over to Spectra Magic. Which do you prefer?
I like the Main Street Electrical Parade. I remember when it first started. I was there one of the first weeks it came out, and it was just unbelievable.
I love it. I absolutely love it. My favourite. I love. Oh, sorry. That's it. See, Kim was saying the really hard questions, and you answered them like that. Fantastic. This is what we like to see, you see. People who know their answers, they know their Disney.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, when you spend as much time there as I've been fortunate enough and blessed to spend there, I mean, yeah, those are fun answers. I love to go.
Well, so how can people contact you through social media and to also buy your book? Would you like to give yourself a little bit of a plug?
Sure, I would be thrilled for that opportunity. People can connect with me on Facebook. By typing in either Jeff Dixon, D-I-X-O-N, or Key to the Kingdom series, Key to the Kingdom book series. Any of those things will get you to the Facebook pages. And if you go there, multiple times each week, there's some kind of Disney trivia, some kind of Disney quote, Disney facts, things like that. If they want to follow me on Twitter, it's Dixon on Disney, Dixon on Disney. And then also the website for the books is geekykingdombook.com. So any of those places are good ways to find and interact and connect. And if people email, and they can email me through any of those sites, I'm pretty good and pretty quick about emailing back. I try to connect as quickly as possible. So I'd love to hear from folks, and they can find ways to get the books through all those sites as well.
Super. And I can vouch for the website. It has some really good videos that you can watch about the book series and photos and things, so definitely hunt that down and have a look.
Yeah, so I'd be thrilled if people would show up and just take a look, and again, let me know what they think. And I also have a YouTube channel. Ooh. That's actually got a preview to the new book on it called Dixon on Disney on YouTube, so any of those places I can be found.
So, well, I just want to say thank you for sparing the time to come on and share that all with us. Really enjoyed having your company this evening, haven't we, Kim?
Yes, definitely, and loved hearing about the world before Walt Disney World, which I still can't quite get my head around, but I'm sure I'll get over it.
I'm so jealous.
Well, I mean, I've had a great time. I'm just, again, I thank you guys so much, not just for having me on, but for what you guys do, for being Disney fans and sharing that with the world. That is just so cool, and so I look forward to maybe getting a chance to talk to you again a little bit later on, and maybe when the other book comes out, if you want to chat about that. Love the opportunity to do it.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, we'll take you up on that 100%.
Okay, good deal.
That would be amazing, definitely.
Then let's plan on that. But again, thank you guys so much. I mean, I'm just, I feel like an honored guest, so appreciate it.
Well, I think that roundabout brings us to the end of this episode.
It does indeed, Kim.
I just want to say a huge thank you to Mr. Disaster Dark, Nick Branch, but also a huge thank you to Jeff Dixon, because that interview was just something else. Then if you haven't seen his book or read about his book, trust me, if you're a fan of Kingdom Keepers, this book is just as good, if not better, in some respects. It's Keys to the Kingdom. You can get it on Amazon. I think it's anything from between £5 to £10.
After his second book has come out, we'll get Jeff back on again. And if you have any particular questions you want to ask him about anything to do with the book and the series, feel free, drop us a line.
Most definitely. He was more than happy to speak to us again, and he was more than happy to answer any of our listeners' questions. So, yeah, what Michelle said, send them in.
Right, well, I've got a few people I'd like to do a bit of a shout-out to.
Oh, you're not feeding my ego, are you?
Not you, no.
I never get shouted out.
Oh, hi, Kim!
Hiya!
Right, can I also say, hi, Tom! Just in case he's listening, because he's not in the room with me at the moment. So when he listens to the podcast, he'll hear me saying, hi, Tom!
Oh, hi, Aaron. Not that you ever listen to my podcast.
Oh, Tom always listens to me. Oh,
hi, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Now, that's enough. His ego doesn't explode. Right. I would like to do a shout-out to Susan Hall, 1970. You find her on Twitter at that address. She's also known as Mousewife. She's a 2013 Disney Mums panel hopeful.
Oh, fingers crossed for you.
So, keeping our fingers crossed. She's going to keep in touch with me, letting me know how she's doing on her pathway to becoming a Disney Mum. And I really hope you get as far as you want to get to, i.e. being a Disney Mum next year. So I just thought I'd give a big shout out to her. Another person I'd like to give a shout out to is to the wonderful Mr. Stephen Maxwell and his family, who will shortly be travelling somewhere we all like, and he's going to do a few special tasks for me and Kim, isn't he, love?
He is, but not like we ever mention Stephen Maxwell on this podcast. I mean, I've never heard of the man Stephen Maxwell.
Our number one listener. So, have a wonderful flight. Hope it's an amazing trip. Enjoy yourself, especially to there in Food and Wine Festival. Mm-hmm. Have an amazing time. Post loads of pictures to make us feel really, 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 really jealous. And thank you very much.
And give Stitch a huge sloppy kiss from me.
Yes.
That sounded just like Stitch.
Did I? All right. Okay. Another couple of people I'd like to say hello to, and then we're going to go.
All right.
Our friends over at the Unofficial Universal Orlando podcast. I said it right that time. I normally struggle. If you love Universal, you love this podcast, and especially at the moment, it's packed with Halloween madness, basically. Go listen to them. Give them a try. Really, really fab podcast. So I want to say hello to them.
Number one podcast for Universal. And seeing as we're saying hello to everybody, can I say hello to Lee Tracy and Darren and the new photo guy whose name I can't remember, but your photographs are really good.
Aww. And finally, friend of the show, Banks Lee, has been very busy, because the Orlando Attractions magazine is reverted back to being a weekly show. At last, hallelujah, woohoo!
I bet you made him do that when you saw him, didn't you? I bet you like took him hostage or something, didn't you?
No, I did not take him hostage at all. Honestly, I think a lot of fans of the show have been saying, we don't want a monthly show for an hour, we'd rather have the half hourly 20 minute shows every week. And he has got an amazing new co-host, JL Knopp, and JL is going to be coming on the show in a few weeks to talk about her experience of becoming a new host on the Orlando Attraction magazine. If you haven't watched the show, it's brilliant. Get onto Google now. Google Orlando Attractions magazine, the show. They have fabulous content on their webpage, lovely videos, and you can go back, subscribe through iTunes, and have some really good ideas of what else Orlando has to offer.
Yeah.
I think I've said enough hello to enough people now, Kim, so shall we say our goodbyes and tell people how they can get in touch with us?
Yay! If you finish listening to Michelle's frets of you have to go listen and watch things, you can contact us on the email address, which is contact@theminiminxes.co.uk.
You can follow us on Twitter @theminiminxes.
You can find us on Facebook, just search for The Mini Minxes.
And if you haven't subscribed to us yet via iTunes, look for The Mini Minxes Disney Podcast. Leave us a review, we'll shout you out on the show. Next show will be out 15th of October, Kim.
Ah, 15th of October, I know that date well. Also, just a quick note, we need your questions for Ask Minxie Michelle, because she is running out of questions. I have asked her one, she is going to answer it next week. She better answer it next week.
Oh no, please. Please, 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 please send in questions really quickly so I don't have to answer Kim's question. Because seriously, it's the world's toughest question. Please.
So yes, please send in your questions because we love getting them. We love giving that Minxie Michelle a challenge. Oh, I think really then all that's left to say is goodbye, really. Everybody enjoy the next 2 weeks and look forward to speaking to you again soon. Mini kisses.
Mwah.